Welcome at Planetary Health Talks, the podcast in which we invite professionals and enthusiasts in the field of planetary health. We discuss its importance, interconnectedness, and application in our everyday lives. This podcast is presented to you by the Knowledge Center Global Health, hosted by Ashish Brahma, that's me, and co-hosted by
Renee Robbers, that's me.
Ladies and gentlemen, another episode of Planetary Health Talks. I'm Ashish Brahma, and today we have a wonderful, wonderful, double-promoted professor. It's Pim Martens, and we've agreed that I can call him Pim during the interview. Mm-hmm. Welcome.
My pleasure.
Pim, I will start off with thanking the Knowledge Center for Planetary Health, because that's the organization that sponsors these interviews and these podcasts. So just having said that, I'd like to know, when you're a little guy, when you're a very young child, what were your dreams to be? Did you want to become a football player or a fireman, or what did you think?
No, well, actually, I want to be a kind of a forest god. So actually walking into the forest and having maybe a little flock of sheep, these kind of things. That were actually the dreams I had when I was a little boy. And of course, I already realized that I wasn't good enough in soccer to become a professional player. So that was never a dream of mine, being very realistic. So that was roughly it.
And so when you get a little bit older, you become a teenager, did anything change? You want to do something else? You want to be a rock star? Or you always kept that dream of being close to nature within your belief system and the way you think?
Yeah, well, actually, it was. I deviated a little bit when I go into my studies and you become a student. That's more, you're not walking every day in nature if you are a student. But principally, and also the last several years, more and more this connection with nature and trying to be out there as much as I can become more and more in my head. So,
And then you studied mathematics.
Yes, well, I studied health sciences for my master's degree, yeah. And I did my PhD in applied mathematics.
Okay.
So that was a great fun, because I also like to play around with computers at that time, very simple and modest. I had to give you an idea. I had a computer when I did my PhD with 100 megabyte disk space, so not much you can do with that compared to current days. But I made very nice integrated models, system dynamic models on climate change and our health. So from that start, so I'm talking about the mid-90s, I'm already doing that.
So you're in your mid-20s or before, and you already had an idea that we need to do something about the climate, or you need to investigate the climate at least.
Yes, well, I was part of a bigger team. We tried to rebuild the World Tree Model, the Club of Rome kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, we tried to do a better job, being a little bit more sophisticated, we thought. I don't know if it succeeded. And my job was then to look at climate change impacts on our health.
So somewhere this nature, maybe your friends, your studies, health sciences, and then mathematics, applied mathematics in the PhD, led to doing climate. Was there a simple point in time that you got inspired to really dive in and spend at least 4 years of your life in doing research? Was there something that somebody or something, some event that inspired you?
Well, I had two very good promoters, both mathematician, and one of them was also a medical doctor. And they both really inspired me, not only to do the job as good as I could, mathematically speaking, but also get a concern that was more out there than just science, and that we're really seeing changes around us that can have a major impact on all of us, on the earth, on animals, on plants, but also on us, humans. So that really inspired me. And then when I started to do my work on these climate change and infectious diseases, I also was in the opportunity to go to African countries, and mm-hmm. there I saw the real impact. Today we see climate change impacts everywhere, but in the 90s of the previous centuries, I really sound old now, we saw mainly the impacts in the tropics, subtropics. So these two things really drove me forward.
You have a young mind, it doesn't matter what your age, it's just a number. I think one of the key issues in science is actually to spread the message, right? And we have these the world of academia, where papers are published that are behind paywalls, and we have the common people. The common people also want to know about your models. They're mathematical of nature. They cannot be very easy to understand. But at that time, could you explain to the common people in Holland or in Brazil, what you were doing?
Well, it's of course always a very difficult job to do the science and then try to communicate it to people that are not knowledgeable on your topic. It even goes to communicate that to other scientists, from other disciplines. So let alone if you take the additional step to a bigger audience. But from the start, I at least tried to do as good as I could. I called myself a scientivist, trying to also be activist by doing my science. But I think nowadays it's better by things like this podcast or by the social media. But of course, at the early days, there was not just a thing. That was even only internet for scientists. But I tried to invest in my presentations, to make these things quite simple, trying to discuss, be it in the Netherlands or in these African countries where I was working at that time, to always interact with people that felt the impacts of climate change at that time. So not only the scientists, but also the villagers or the farmers in one way or the other. And again, I have no clue how successful or unsuccessful I was, but I felt the urgency to do that still.
Yeah, it must have influenced. I have a shared experience that you have working in Africa and Asia a lot. And what I've learned most is from, I would say, from nurses being a doctor, but also from the people themselves. And you said that early in the 90s, something must have come through that you realized that climate change was very much an issue. Well, in the 90s, was there a big attention for climate and climate change in the Netherlands, for example?
Well, worldwide, especially if you talk about climate impacts on our health. You may know that in the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change reports, in the first report, nothing was mentioned about health. It was only the second report, where it was a very short chapter, which I was part of, that actually said, well, hey, wait a minute, climate change could really have an impact on our health.
This is mid-90s, right?
Yes, mid-90s. Exactly, mid-90s. So, and of course, when you just mentioned it in the scientific area, in the general public, and still I think the attention is way too low, but at that time it definitely was not considered to be important. So I also was quite naive thinking that, well, hey, if now I'm looking at the health implications, people start listening, because sea level rise in 2100, okay, who cares? But if something is really important for you or for your children, then they may start listening. But again, I was quite naive and not really so much.
You don't sound so naive. What happened after this? So you did your first PhD mm-hmm. in applied mathematics and this modeling in climate. And then what did you start working? Because I heard in our conversation before that you actually did a second PhD.
That's a long story, but I will make it short. After my PhD in applied mathematics, I started to work as an assistant professor for some time. And then together with one of my inspirational supervisors, we started a sustainability institute, mm-hmm. At Maastricht University. So we did that for quite some time. He was the first director, I was the second one. And then I started to work more and more on sustainable development. And sustainable development is everything and nothing at the same time. So I thought the last few years of that chair that I would need to focus. And I really thought that our relationship with animals in Asia should be a kind of a central piece of sustainability. And I always trying to think in a more concrete way. And then I knew a professor of zoology of Aberystwyth University in Wales. And he was able to attract some PhD. So I was just sitting around the table with him, a good friend for me as well. And said, well, hey, wouldn't you like to have a somewhat older PhD student who trying to discover a completely new field? And he said, well, great. So basically, it's only 2-3 years ago that I got my second PhD in biological sciences of Aberystwyth University.
Wow. Yeah. And what did that change? Because I think if you understand the methodology of making mathematical models, that's one part, that's one way of looking at life. But I think it's like you look at science from different perspectives. Like you're capable of shifting from mathematical view to a more biological view to what is the impact of animals on humans on animals on the planet. Mm-hmm. So what did a second PhD bring you?
Well, it brought me several things. Not only the joy of doing that
sure.
In a more structured way and to be part of another team, broadening my scope, which is very close to my interest. But it also, I thought it brought me closer to what's really important if you think not only on sustainable development, but also on planetary health as such. And that is our relationship with biological systems, with nature, with animals, with everything surrounding us. And of course, we're doing the applied mathematics. I think I become the trained system thinker. So I already realized that everything is connected. but still it's then quite rather vague. I also experienced that if you put up an equation in a paper and in a presentation,
likewise with a map. Asleep. Oh,
no,
sorry.
No. Well, hopefully not, but people believe you. One reason or the other. If you put in a map or an equation, people think, well, that's a real scientist. They're doing really something that's important. But even although they may believe me, they didn't change. So that was another reason I started doing this more biological interaction with animals and nature kind of thing, thinking that, well, maybe if you respect animals, if you respect nature, then the world may look a better place or becomes more sustainable in terms also of the health of our planet.
So it's your third PhD in philosophy?
Who knows? I have no plans yet, but never say
you
no.
You never know.
Yeah.
So coming back to this team, you just mentioned something very beautiful. I think a team gives an opportunity, not only in sports, but also in science and thinking. When you collaborate, you can get much further. The African saying, of course, is alone you go fastest, but together you work for furthest. So that's something that you reflect here. Say a team is very beautiful for me. Mm-hmm. Can you tell something about your periods in teams? We're going to talk later about, of course, your current job.
Yeah.
And what does a team mean to you?
Well, I always find it very strange, even though with my own PhDs, if people published, if they're working on planetary health issues or sustainability, if you would publish alone or do your work alone, because by definition, it's multi-inter-transdisciplinary, meaning that you work together with other scientists, that you also work together with people outside academia, so villagers, farmers, what else you have, because it's just too complex to do it on your own. So you need to think across borders of disciplines. You need to be communicative with other people as well. And of course, it's also great fun. If you think you know it all, you probably won't come that far, referring also to your African saying.
You don't know anything.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So you also realize by actually making also models, which I did in my first PhD, you also realize what you don't know. And that's probably even more important than to think of what you do know. And working with others, you can hopefully fill these gaps or at least communicate and trying to make the difference together.
So you can get a smart group of people around you who have been trained, PhD students or PhDs, but in the end of the day, having a normal conversation with a normal person is actually very helpful. And you dropped something about indigenous people and their wisdom. So I'd like to know that, where did you encounter these indigenous people, and you know, what reflection did they give you on the planet and the life on the planet? You made a very nice anecdote when we started talking, so maybe you can repeat.
Yes, the anecdote I made was that I spoke to one of the indigenous leaders, and he mentioned, and that for me is the core of planetary health, if you respect nature and everything that lives in it, you respect yourself as well. And I really like that. But coming back to your question, that actually it was a pre-corona project, in the Vrije Universiteit, Free University of Amsterdam, between the Institute of Environmental Studies and the Faculty of Religion and Theology.
Okay.
It was great fun, so I applied for it, I got it. And my intention was to just meet one or two indigenous or religious leaders, and then Corona came. Now, for all the bad things for this project, it was a good thing because I managed to interview 12 people through Zoom.
Wow.
So 12 indigenous and religious leaders. So varying from a Dakota chief to a Maasai leader and shaman of Greenland, but also a Buddhist nun, the bishop of Roermond of the Netherlands, an imam, a rabbi, well, all these kind of different people. And we discussed about everything, about climate change, biodiversity loss, planetary health, our relationship with animals and natures, and first of all, you could see a difference between some of the indigenous leaders and the religious one. Some of the key religions, they presented a somewhat we are on top of nature kind of perspective. Although they realized that we need to take care of nature in a very good way, and we don't do it in that way.
So it's
we
a stewardship.
Are in charge. Stewardship are the literal words, stewardship. While the indigenous leaders, they consider ourselves more like being part of nature. So we're just among the many living and non-living creatures that are part of the planet Earth. And that makes a huge difference if you then look to how we should relate to that. You can take a very anthropocentric point of view, so a human-centric point of view, thinking, well, hey, we need to take care of our planet because we need that. Mm-hmm. We need to take care of animals or crops, because if they fail or become sick, it will affect us. Again, nothing wrong with that. Huh? That's a perfect natural vision, I think. But personally, I think we should go one step further, and that's more the indigenous point of view, is that we are all connected. So we should respect nature and the planet Earth anyway, regardless whether or not it benefits us. Because you could argue if we need the blue whale, I think we do need them. They're quite important in the ocean ecosystem. But you could argue that if you need them for us. But that's not the point. You should protect them or not kill them for their own sake. Regardless of it has a human beneficial effect in health or whatever you can call it. Mm-hmm. And that were the very interesting differences I found when interviewing these people.
Well, you're a scientist, but you're also a human being. Which would you prefer, being a steward or being part of nature?
Well, I think there's no choice. We are part of nature. I think we cannot decide to be steward because that will fail one way or the other.
That's happening sooner or later. That's happening on the planet right now, right?
Yeah.
That's why I'm not going to talk to you about this meeting in Sharm el-Sheikh, because I believe in what people do and what difference they make. And there's a saying that I like Dakota people. I have a couple of friends who are Lakota. And one of the saying is that they don't know ownership of land. And then the white man came and put up gates, put up fences. And they were looking at these, what are you doing? This is common ground, common hunting ground. It's a deep philosophical difference in understanding our role in nature.
Yeah, it's very nice that you mentioned that. I can give another example of Solomon Wawiti. He's from Canada, one of the native Canadians. And he told also an old story that he said, well, if at the early days, when the white men were asked, how do you want your animals? And then the white man says, I want them close to me. And then he forgot that he needed to take care of them. He got the cow, he got the chicken and these kind of things. And then the native man said, I want them to be just like me, to be free. And he got the eagle. So it's typically the more anthrop versus ecocentric point of view you have regarding everything that surrounds you. So it relates to the thing you were just saying.
Yeah, or the philosophy of Ubuntu, togetherness, right? Mm-hmm. It takes a village to raise a child.
Yeah.
And if you want to become melancholic, you can talk about Western society. There's a lot of beauty here. There's a lot of wisdom here. But those are things that are dribbling away almost. This togetherness. It's a lot about me, myself, and I. But you have started, together with a group of people, a new campus in Venlo, of all places. You go to Venlo.
No, yeah, well, the campus has there been for some time and really is meant to has several purposes. Eh? Mm-hmm. In the northern part of Limburg, it's Maastricht University. There is a lot of work ongoing relating to food and agriculture.
Okay.
And again, that's, of course, also the key for us. We all need to eat. And also the key for the health of the planet, because that's a very, not only at the moment, a real cause of how we are not managing our Earth properly, but it can also be a solution to reverse it, to regenerate our way of living. And combined with that, the campus really is a place where we try to do the work in an inter- and transdisciplinary way. So it's not like, and not again, nothing wrong with the disciplines. They are all needed. We stand on the shoulder of the disciplines, but we need to also be interactive with them. We really need to connect them in order to deal with the current complexity of the problems we see, like climate change, biodiversity loss, how do we ensure a healthy and a sustainable food system for all of us. And that's quite nice. So all these kind of things, future developments, future health, future food, we are thinking about in Venlo with a very nice team of people that, of course, has also its links with our mother in Maastricht, Maastricht University, and all other universities in the Netherlands and worldwide that are actually thinking in the same lines.
Yeah, I get inspired about young people. I had an interview yesterday with Arte, who is a young doctor, and she's so well-versed already, so young and having read so much. How's your interaction with the youth? I mean, and what kind of people are flocking towards Venlo to do research? Could you say something about them? We're almost the same age. I won't say how old you are, but we're almost the same age. And How do you relate to those 18 to 24-year-olds, sometimes 25 to 30-year-olds? Yeah. I mean, do they have a different view of the world? Or is
well, I must say, yeah, of course, I teach already for almost 30 years, so students remain the same age, more or less.
Yeah? Sure, but you get older.
We get older.
And grayer.
But I see a tendency that students, especially students that come to Venlo, but in general, I also sometimes give guest lectures at other places, mm-hmm. they are quite concerned. Obviously, mm-hmm. It's their future, but they also are quite enthusiastic and willing to make a difference. And the question is how long that remains. Of course, you lose touch with them if they leave the university. But that's actually one of the things I like doing best. I call myself a scientivist, but you have different ways of being this scientivist. You can stand on the barricades or you can do a lot of things. And personally, I choose my battles, and I think my main task would be to inspire, to talk to PhDs. I have also, I think, above average number of PhDs because I really like doing that. And they're the future. They inspire me as well. Likewise, bachelor's and master's students, they are quite interested in what I do. They always ask me, what can I do? So they really want to make a change. They're also not naive. They know, and they're also quite open to say, well, hey, I don't want to be very, very sober. I also want to enjoy life. And he says, sure. Well, it can go hand in hand. You don't need to be a kind of a monk to make the world a better place or to become more sustainable. But there are some small things you can do. And they really are interested, and also they inspire me with their questions and their mode of action.
Yeah. So for me, when you look at the world and you want change, it goes either bottom up or top down or a mix of the two. And there's a combination of the two. I like the bottom up approach. And I think you like that as well. I haven't heard you talk about influencing maybe our future leaders. Yes, because you influence mm-hmm. PhD students. You want to be an inspiration, probably. And I'm sure you are. But how do you inspire those people or change their mentality when it comes to civil leaders like politicians, captains of industry?
Well, that's quite a difficult job. You are absolutely right that in order to change, to make a transition or whatever you can call it, you would need both. You would need the bottom up and the top down. If you get on the different levels, people pushing forward together, then you will have the correct pace and everything will move forward. In terms of policy, I think that's quite difficult. I'm sorry to say that, but you see that, there's a lot of disinformation, because it's so complex. It's very difficult to understand, I think, as a local, national, international policymaker what's really ongoing. But even they are smart enough, so they should grasp the key thing. Mm-hmm. But we saw it in Egypt, not much happened. Mm-hmm. And that because there are so many other things at stake. There are other interests. They usually take a shorter term perspective than really is needed. And I've experienced in many cases that, and again, when I started to do my work, I was also a quite naive scientist. I thought, well, hey, here's me, here's us scientists say that climate is changing, that health will be impacted. Act.
That should be enough, right?
Yeah.
I'm presenting the facts. But come and take me.
Yeah, but take that doesn't work that way. Just to give an anecdote, I did some work on climate change and malaria. Mm-hmm. And I finished my report and I literally went to the Minister of Health in The Hague, presented it there and said, well, hey, no, it's climate. It should be the Minister of Environment. So, and then in The Hague, you can cross the street to go to the other ministry.
Yeah.
And they set me the other way around. No, it's about malaria, so it's health. So this is typically a little bit this siloed approach, yes. Which also has a long history.
Yes.
That isn't helpful in this complex thing, in this complexity that we see with planetary health issues.
But it's like your bread and butter, right? You're a complexity man. This is what you've studied probably from very young, and it's complex for a reason. Mm-hmm. So my question is always, how do you present those very difficult, complex issues in a very intelligible and understandable way? Do you use storytelling? Do you use images? How do you go about to bring it? How do you do it?
Well, it's of course quite complex, especially because I'm not trained in communicating kind of things. I'm not a communicator by training, so I just try to do my best. And I think for whatever you do, honesty and openness is very important. Don't pretend something you do not know or and also show how clumsy you sometimes are in your messaging. Why not? You are a scientist.
You're human.
Yeah, exactly. But also don't stay in your academic ivory tower. That's also not something you want to do. Also, do not dismiss that some people are not knowledgeable about the topic. If you are a politician, you can't expect them to be a kind of a climate scientist. So also respect the others. Don't dismiss them for not listening. I think you rather can take them on board than to leave them out. And that you see happening more and more. When I did my first climate change human health model, I just did it myself on my computer. And if you listen carefully to what we just have said, not smart to do that. It's always a kind of a teamwork. But I also never consulted policymakers. What are your questions? What do you want to know? So I thought whatever I threw out to them would be something they wanted to know. No, they have different ideas. They want to know, can we do something about it? Can we have a kind of a control measure? They're not so much interested in the impact. And that's also the reason why more and more we call it also transdisciplinarity. So we actually involve others. That can be politicians, but it can also be CEOs of industry. It can be lay people, can be farmers, to involve them from the start of a scientific project. Because we don't know everything. Sometimes there's a huge amount of knowledge, like the indigenous leaders. We are all indigenous to the earth, one of them said. So also in the Netherlands, you have
indigenous people
that are indigenous. They are not stupid farmers. They know what needs to be done. Likewise with lay people. So involve them. They have their own role to play. They have their own knowledge to tell. They have their own insights. And by the end of the day, they need to do the things. I can say something that you should farm in this way or you should build your houses in that way. But if I only say that, I'm not the house builder or the farmer. So they need to be also sharing that urgency from the start.
I think we need to weave the narrative together.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
When you say you're not a natural communicator, it's clear that you explain very, very lucidly, very loosely, very easily for people to understand, because these are complex issues to talk about. So at this point in the interview, I'd just like to ask you, is there something you would like to share, something that you want to, but I didn't ask you about? Is there something?
Well, what I would like to share is that if you talk about planetary health issue, climate change, biodiversity, our health, sustainability, it's not easy, but it's not so complex that we are not able to act. It's a kind of a delicate balance, I think, also I experienced myself as a scientist, trying to simplify it. But not making it too simple. Things should be as simple as possible, or explanations should be as simple as possible, but not simpler. That's basically what I'm always balancing about. Because you also see a lot of misinterpretations. I think the Sustainable Development Goals are a very key example. They are excellent. Everybody adheres to them because they're all positive. That's another thing. Try to keep that positive attitude. But then a lot of organizations, countries, what else you have, they pick out one or two. And that's actually what you don't want to do, because they are connected. Hey, you can really improve one of the Sustainable Development Goals, but it doesn't mean that all the others will go up as well. Sometimes it can even be counter-effective. So this complexity also, I think, includes that you're also allowed to make mistakes in terms of adaptation, in terms of making... we don't know, but try. Sometimes it's just a matter of... in Dutch, verder denken dan je neus lang is. Thinking a little bit longer than your nose is long. I think very badly translated, good. Like Louis van Gaal.
Sounds like very clear what you're saying.
So, and that's sometimes enough.
Yeah, but willing to laugh. So I'm interested about those skill labs you're talking about. Like, so you put all these different people from different disciplines with different vocabulary, with different approach, with different models, with different methodologies. I believe in serious gaming.
I think part of it.
For me, modeling is really about what you do is mathematical modeling is wonderful, beautiful. For me, it's like role play and putting people through scenarios and letting them together decide what options are, what different options you can create when you're faced with difficulty and put them in a pressure cooker.
Times. These are all elements that are part of these labs, or rural labs, or urban labs, or living labs are different names for the same. And the idea is that in an interactive way, you stimulate people to think. That can be through walking with them through an area and asking them, what would you like to see here? A kind of a vegetable garden, or would you like to have a parking place? Because that sometimes is necessary.
Sure.
Near a train station, for example. You can stimulate them by showing pictures, because sometimes it's difficult to visualize.
Yeah.
But you can draw a picture. I did once an exercise to ask people to describe our future relationship with animals. Do we all have a pet that very much looks like us, or do we get rid of pets at all because we think, well, hey, that's not a natural thing to have something so closely to you and treating like a little baby or so. You can think about very extreme things, unforeseeing, and that can be quite fun. It's really thinking out of the box. Mm-hmm. It's something that you probably never think of. Mm-hmm. But if you're with a few people together, you can stimulate each other. And to be honest, especially these very out-of-the-box scenarios, they can be very helpful, and it can be sometimes even very much close to the truth.
Like the black swan.
Like the black swan. We did once an exercise on future health, and we invented in our scenarios a panic virus, which very much looked like the corona pandemic we saw.
Okay.
Originated between close contacts between animals and humans. And again, that's not rocket science. A lot of zoologists and people that are interested or knowledgeable about zoonotic diseases.
So everybody was panicking.
Same.
And everybody was panicking.
Yeah. So these kind of things you can do quite nicely in these groups. And again, the added value is that you have knowledge you never thought of yourself, and you have them on board. You actually have them being part of the exercise, because by the end of the day, you all want the same. If you talk about these exercises, you want to make a difference, a positive difference. You want to reduce impacts of climate change. You want to develop an urban or rural area. You want to improve a certain natural area. So all these things are common of interest to both the scientists and the people mm-hmm. involved.
So we've been meandering through your life. We talked about your boyhood, when you want to become a forest man, a forest keeper with perhaps some sheep. And then you became a mathematician after doing health sciences. And then you become a biologist and a professor and an inspirator and a storyteller and an activist and a scientist all in one. And slowly, both of us were heading towards the end of our lives. Where do you see yourself after your career? Or is your career not going to stop when you're 91?
Well, as far as I'm concerned, you never know.
Depending on your health, on circumstances. Let's say you'll be 90 years old.
Yeah. Well, I hope to be involved in all the things you can do. I think you grow, in general, wiser if you become older. So especially this supervising of young adults, be it master, bachelor students or PhD students, is still something I definitely want to do as long as I can.
Until you drop.
But already making a slow move. I used to be quite an office person, sitting behind my computers, making models, having, of course, my empirical work, going to Africa, catching up with the local communities mm-hmm, there, mm-hmm. but all with the intention to bring that back to my home, to feed it into my models. Yeah. And more and more, I feel the urge and also the interest to go out more often. So I'm interesting. I have a little together with my partner, a plot of land, very small, but we're trying to grow some vegetables there, and we have a wild camera, so being a little bit more in nature. And that, again, doesn't need to be your own piece of land, but I think trying to stimulate other people as well to also understand and appreciate the beauty of nature. It doesn't always need to be a fantastic coral reef or a beauty white bounty beach or whatever you have. It can also be close by. And I hope that in the corona time, everybody started walking because not much else you could do at that time. But I don't see it took stock. I think people are still trying to do the things they did before corona. And I really mm-hmm. hope to, including myself, you can start with yourself, obviously, to take and appreciate that go out. It's so nice. And of course, you have your job, you have your, with this weather that you stay indoors. But appreciate the beauty of everything. It can be in your garden, in cities. But also just in your local neighborhood. And with that, and then I come back to the comment I made about respecting nature, respecting animals, respecting yourself. I really hope that automatically we take care of nature, we take care of plants, we do not cut a tree as easily as we do nowadays. We don't eat as much meat as we do. Mm-hmm. We try to get rid of the bio industry, because that all doesn't resonate with what I think should be the key of planetary health.
That's cool. Those are beautiful take-home messages. to think about and to ponder about. And so you said you have children. You don't have grandchildren yet. Lucky you. Mm. Just wait and see. But what I learned from all indigenous people is that they have such a richness. Those stories, sitting behind the campfire and sharing, because that's our, you know, our connection. And I hear you're talking a lot about connection with the planet, connection with plants and people and animals. And I'm not going to say where did it go wrong, because I see a lot of people doing it in the nice way. But you have hope. You see that our planet will be there in 50 years, and people on top of it will be there as well.
Yeah, of course. I think you always need to be hopeful, and that's also, I think, we need to start moving in a positive direction, because it's so nice to appreciate the beauty that's around us, and we still have, I think, time to do so. I'm definitely hopeful for the planet, because the planet will survive anyway.
Yeah, without us.
And we'll be one time in the history of the planet definitely without us, because we will get extinct in 1 million, 2 million, whatever amount of years, and probably the Earth will be still be around.
Sure.
But of course, we are talking a little bit closer in time to our current times. I still see hope, because first of all, we need to. It's no way, other way around. I see signals that people are appreciating more and more that we are part of nature, that we can do so much better in a way. It's not that we are stupid. We're becoming to realize that. And in a worst case scenario, I have even hope, because then the Earth will tell us. Then we'll get signals back, and then we need to. But then it will be at a lot of damage to us, and we try to avoid that, of course. But by the end of the day, it will be a kind of a natural equilibrium that will force us, either by ourselves, with our paradigm shift, with our mental shift, or that nature forces us to be more respectful and to try to avoid to do as much damage as we do today.
COVID-19 gave us a warning shot, but as you say, you don't see a lot of systemic, sustainable, thrivable change.
I think the shock was a little bit too soft.
Too little.
It really is. That's, of course, with all damage done economically and for people that suffered from the disease. But still, if you see how quickly we go back to normal, because the shock was minor, if you look at
on the larger scale of life, yes.
And of course, you don't want to have bigger shocks to change, that's what I was just saying, but you can also change from a paradigm shift, I think. And that takes time. It's not easy. Sometimes people say you need 20-25% of people with a change in paradigm, and then the rest will follow in due time. We're not there yet, but again,
we're at 5%.
I'm 5-10, but I'm hopeful that maybe the next generation, you never know, but at least I try to do my best to get some of them, hopefully, at least the mindset of being critical and think about what you're doing and what the impact is on the health of the planet.
You seem to have a very creative mind. Do you think there's a role for music, musicians, poets, artists, painters, sculptors, installation artists, spoken prose people to, you know, fill the gap, to connect?
Oh, definitely. I think the creativity is a key thing in order to think also about solutions. There are some projects also in Maastricht where the Jan van Eyck Academy, which is a kind of an artist academy, works together with scientists to think about climate change and how you can create adaptive measures and so. And when I heard this question, I always need to think about, I think it was called Project 50. So it was a project where way back, so several decades ago, where scientists, policymakers, artists, and the lay people were asked to sketch the future in 50 years from now. And then 50 years later, we could check. And those that were closest by were the artists. They were closest to reality. And those that were farthest away were the policymakers. And then the scientists and the lay people were somewhere in between. So you can imagine the importance of creativity about thinking about future development, solutions, impacts. We definitely need arts there as well.
When I hear your faculty, it sounds really like creativity is important. And unfortunately, what I hear in university as well is that there's a lot of rote learning and not real system think. So I'm hoping that your methodology of teaching can be, you know, in the medical education, because we seem to be inundated with a lot of factual knowledge and systems. And sometimes I feel like creativity is being snuffed out. But what you say about the artist seeing best what the future will bring is that resonates with me. And I think a true scientist is actually an artist.
I think there are a lot of similarities between being creative as a scientist with your mind, or being creative as an artist with your mind, and then you express it more in something concrete usually, yeah? Being a novel, being it a painting or whatever. So I definitely see the same as you. There are similarities between them.
And you got to be a little bit of a rebel, right? I hear you publish all your papers online.
Yeah, that's something. Yeah, I actually do. So fortunately, more and more scientific publications become open access, as we call them, so actually available for all, which is a good thing, of course. My job is being paid by public money.
Yes.
University people are being paid by public money.
Yes.
So I think it makes common sense that everything I write and publish should be available for everyone. And again, it's improving, but it used to be, and still in some cases, I try to avoid that because you can select to which journal you submit your paper. But if a journal is not open access, I make it available on my own website because I feel everybody should be able to take a look at it.
Feels good. Feels very beautiful. Pim Martens, I'm going to ask you one more time. Is there anything you wish to share with us or share with the audience? Maybe you want to ask me a question.
Well, again, what I really want to share is that don't be inactive for whatever reason. Is it the complexity that you are overwhelmed with, or maybe some negative feelings because the news is all about negative things? But be active, be positive, because all of us can make a positive change, I think, in this whole domain of planetary health and sustainability.
Be the change you want to see.
Exactly.
Mahatma Gandhi. I think that's a beautiful finishing. I want to thank you, Professor Pim Martens, double PhD holder, extraordinary human being, inspiration and leader, science activist. Wonderful.
My pleasure.
Keep the muse going. Thank you very much for this interview. This was the Knowledge Center Public Health, Planetary Health. Thank you very much for listening. See you around next time. I'm Ashish Brahma. Thank you, Tessa, for being here.